Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Finance Committee meeting to order. Morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all. And wondering if Katie, you'd be willing to take our attendance this morning. Good morning. Please go ahead when you're ready.
Chair Lilly.
Here.
Chair Lilly, present. Vice Chair Jordan.
Here.
Rep Jordan here. Representative Green.
Here.
Green present. Representative Acomb.
Acomb present.
Acomb present. Representative Anderson.
Anderson here.
Anderson present. Representative Bow.
Bow is present.
Bow present. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Christensen present. Representative Hassan. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Nelson present. Representative Erdahl.
Present.
Erdahl present. Representative Wasilewicz.
Wasilewicz present.
Wasilewicz present. Representative Zhang.
Here.
Zhang present.
We're good to go. We have a quorum. Great. Thank you very much for your help. And so with that, I wonder if Representative Jordan, would you be willing to move the minutes from our February 10th meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I reviewed the minutes from February 10th and I move them.
Thank you. Any questions in regards to the minutes? I don't see any waving hands or anything. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Thank you, Representative Jordan. We have minutes that are approved. I just want to start. We one of our key staff, Molly Peterson, just want to mention she here on the DFL team lost her father, and just I don't know the details, but anyways, it's just kind of sad to somebody to lose someone in this time. And I don't know that it's COVID related or anything, but it's just still a sad story. So good morning. Thank you everyone for joining us. This might be the last cold day of winter, but got some great stories to hear about. I Representative Jordan, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to move your bill. We have a House File 625. And get that before us. Representative Jordan.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 625 be laid over.
So we have that motion, and thank you, Representative Jordan. It's I'm very excited to start hearing some bills and hear about projects generally. And we're going to have a mixture of just hearing about projects and bills as we move forward this session. Again, upstairs are a little tied up, but it's starting to loosen up, but we definitely are going to be hearing a mixture and a lot of great projects. So Representative Jordan, kick us off.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, fellow members of the committee. I wish we were in person so I could have brought us some coffee and pastries. I think nourishing and local breakfast would have been a fitting companion for House File 625, which would grant $250,000 from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to Appetite for Change for their Community Cooks program. The Community Cooks program delivers meal boxes to families to learn to cook traditional meals with fresh local ingredients. Appetite for Change is based just across the river from my district over in North Minneapolis. And with their Community Cooks program, Appetite for Change collaborates with community organizations to directly serve families experiencing food insecurity and a lack of access to fresh and nutritious food. These meal boxes include instructions for a family-friendly and wholesome meal grounded in traditional food ways. Food is an essential component of our cultural heritage. And learning to prepare food unique to our history and families connects us to our ancestors and enables us to share who we are with our friends, families, and neighbors. The Community Cooks program also celebrates Minnesota's rich agricultural traditions by partnering with local farms such as the Good Acre and connects urban Twin Cities-based families with where their food was grown. I'm honored to have worked on this proposal with Appetite for Change, and I'm glad in this committee we can have conversations about what our food says about where we came from and our shared values as Minnesotans. I'm proud that we can address food insecurity and nutrition while celebrating our cultural heritage. I will also add that as a former 4-H member, I'm pleased that with the Community Cooks program, my neighbors are learning about agriculture beyond attending the state fair once a year. And finally, I'm happy that both DFLers and Republicans, both the House and the Senate, recognize the power of food. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Michelle Horowitz and Daryl Lindsay from Appetite for Change to talk more about the Community Cooks program and answer any technical questions about their program or the bill that members may have.
Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. Ms. Horowitz?
Thank you, Mr.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to you and to members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Jordan, for being our lead author on this bill. We are really grateful for your leadership and just a pleasure to be here with you all this morning. I think that I'm allowed to share my screen. Can I do that right now? Okay, great.
Just state your name for the record, please.
Oh, yes, thank you. Michelle Horowitz, Vice President of Innovation and co-founder of Appetite for Change.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Appetite for Change is a nonprofit social enterprise in North Minneapolis, and our mission is to use food as a tool to build health, wealth, and social change. We were founded in 2011, and our first year of programming began in 2012, in which my co-founders, Princess Haley and Latasha Powell, we invited and co-created with the community our organization. We didn't want to presume that we knew what was going to be best or what the needs were in our community. So we brought together over 400 North Minneapolis residents, families, to cook, eat, and talk about the change that they wanted to see in themselves, in their families, and in the community. And we heard loud and clear what people wanted, and what they wanted was a lot of change in our food system and being able to connect with their family around the dinner table and sort of not lose the art of cooking and the traditional food ways of their families and their culture. But most importantly, they wanted to come back together and cook and eat and talk with one another. So this is a couple of photos from our community cooks workshops. Daryl's going to talk more about the program and the request, but I just wanted to give you a visual. This is sort of how we measure success at our organization from a metric standpoint. We're trying to get people to eat more fresh and local food, increase people's ability to earn more income, and increase more social connectedness. And culture and heritage is a big part of that. We are losing our culture and our food ways with fast food, convenience food. And this is a picture of Daryl and our youth at the farmers market that we run on West Broadway. Many of you may have been to the farmers market. You may also know us from our social enterprise cafe and catering operation called Breaking Bread. And Chair Lilly and Representative Zhang and others who are in the St. Paul area, we're happy that right before COVID, we were able to expand our programming into St. Paul and partner with Ramsey County at the Union Depot to open up a restaurant there to support our workforce development and to also bring our food to the east side. So we're looking forward to bringing that back and being able to do more events. But we talk about real food for real people. This is a picture of one of our meal box distributions. Unfortunately, during COVID, we weren't allowed to, and it wasn't safe to bring families together to do our Community Cooks program. So we innovated and we started our Community Cooks meal boxes, which has allowed us to still bring that cultural connection to food, to introduce new and old recipes and to make that connection between urban and rural by connecting folks to where their food comes from. This is an example of one of our boxes with a recipe. We also highlight the different growers and different local food partners that we work with. There's a vegetarian recipe and animal protein recipe, all using local animal protein. And these are just some of the testimonials that some of our participants have shared with us. And they take pictures of the recipes. This is not one of ours. This is one of theirs. And, it's just an amazing way for kids to get involved, for the whole family, and to pass that generational knowledge of agriculture and food preparation down through the generations. So before I hand it off to Daryl Lindsay, our Vice President of Programming, I just want to just share a little bit about this request. It would support our Community Cooks program and allow us to expand it, and Daryl will go more into that, but I do think that this is an excellent opportunity for this committee and for the state of Minnesota to recognize that there is important culture and heritage to be preserved for all Minnesotans, and that it isn't just, our traditional Scandinavian heritage or, dominant culture heritages that we want to be able to preserve and connect with. And this is an amazing opportunity for BIPOC communities and folks of color to be able to reap the benefits of the Legacy Fund and to be able to mutually benefit and enrich our communities. And with that, I thank you again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Jordan, for authoring the bill, and I will hand it off. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Horowitz. Good job. Mr. Lindsay, can you please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, committee members. My name is Daryl Lindsay. I'm the Vice President of Programming for Appetite for Change. I've been with the organization since 2013. By way of history, I know of three generations of my own family that have grown food. It was my grandmother who taught me how to grow, and my parents continued that. Although we lived in Los Angeles, California, we did maintain a home garden where we were able to harvest quite a bit of produce and grow produce ourselves. I've been in the Twin Cities since 1996, and upon arriving, one of the things I discovered that there was certain items that I wanted to eat that were not available to me in North Minneapolis or at other grocery stores around the Twin Cities area. So I did what I was taught to do as a child. I grew them myself. I quickly discovered that many community members were quite appreciative of that because they had historical ties to certain foods that were not available at that time in the Twin Cities. I was really excited to be a part of Appetite for Change because what we call urban agriculture now, I thought was just feeding myself when I was growing food on vacant lots in the early years of 1996 and the 2000s. What Community Cooks is we invite the community to come in and share a free meal with us, and we only ask for sweat equity, which means that we'll go out and buy all the items for a particular meal, set up workstations for the main entree, for the salad, for the dessert, for the drink, and community members come in and go to the station that they're most comfortable with and begin preparing a meal. This is quite powerful because now folks begin sharing in a very real and genuine way their experiences around food. It also is very educational. We've dealt with different groups of people across town, and there is quite a bit of cultural information sharing as to how people prepare food. I mean, one of the earliest recollections I have is we were with a group of Hispanic community members, and one of the dishes we were going to make included using avocado. And the question became, how do you keep the guacamole from turning brown? And everybody had all these various ideas. But in the end, we were told that all you do is put the seed back in it and, voila. It's like, wow, that was really simple. It comes with the seed and it's green then. And so if you put it back in there, it'll stay green. Okay, great. So there's great information sharing there, but more importantly, by sharing this meal with the community members, we're able to have genuine conversations about what folks need, what folks are looking for, what help is necessary in the community, and people share this. We do community cooks in three different ways. One we call Family South, which is from the baby to grandparents can come and be a part of the event. Another one is our new moms. This is because we discovered that there were a number of parents, new parents, that needed information about how to nutritiously provide meals for their newborns and young children. And then finally, we do a youth community cooks. Our teens told us in no uncertain terms, they needed their own space to figure out how to cook and what they wanted to eat. And we made that happen. And that both the new moms and our youth community cooks seem to be the most popular. Those areas continue to grow for us on a regular basis. The community cooks, as Michelle said, because it is heavily face-to-face, but because of the COVID-19 vaccine pandemic, we've had to pivot and go to the meal boxes. Now, the good thing about that is because we continue to grow produce, and AFC, since 2014, grows roughly 11,000 pounds of produce per season in North Minneapolis on various lots there. We've also partnered with Big River Farms and grown some food there. But in any event, we were able to pivot, go to the meal boxes, and with the help of Good Acre, include our locally grown produce in the meal boxes. And the feedback we got from the community was overwhelmingly positive, because they their words were that this was a meal box with dignity, because they weren't getting secondhand food or... I'm sorry, can you hear me?
We can now. Yep, you just cut out. Okay. Just for a brief second.
Okay. Well, the community really appreciated those meal boxes. And as Michelle showed, they've sent videos, they've sent pictures of them and what they're doing in the homes with the meals. And it's helping people reconnect quite a bit, especially in this really, really trying time where we've got to be socially distanced. It's helping them to reestablish relationships and cultural relationships with the food that they're eating. We appreciate the opportunity to request funds from the Legacy Fund at this point in time. A couple of things that we want to do with those funds is not only continue the meal box program, but expand it and incorporate many more virtual elements in it. As you can imagine, if folks are in a position where they've got food insecurity, housing insecurity, they don't have a lot of IT and they don't have a lot of equipment, so that we can do things virtually. And, you know, just by giving it to them doesn't solve the problem. We also need to provide training and some type of support so that we can help them do this. We think that's very important, because we don't know the changes that the pandemic is going to cause in our community, but we know there's going to be changes. Right now, youth are struggling with trying to do virtual education. Many in our community were struggling with face-to-face education, and now to be faced with this virtual reality is really, really tough. So we really do hope this committee considers the importance of us continuing this work and providing to continue this work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. That was interesting, the avocado story, and you get a gold star for running a telephone and the Zoom on the thing on the computer as well. I'm impressed. So anything else, Representative Jordan, before we get to member questions?
Just Mr. Chair, I think this is really, I was really honored, and I've loved learning about this Community Cooks program. I think it's really great to think about how all the different aspects of our culture and how different people have different food techniques, and but it all really comes together. And I think food is a real uniter of our culture. So I was really happy to work with Appetite for Change on this and support their great work.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. I see some questions. Representative Erdahl, I believe your hand was up first. Good morning. Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
All right. Good morning. And, you know, I just want to emphasize, I think that, you know, this is an important program. Food, dialogue, and relationships go together. And that's why, you know, people may be unaware, but we have an unofficial group in the legislature called the Nutrition Commission, of which I'm the self-appointed chair. And we meet, you know, frequently during the week to have dinner together. And again, build those dialogues and relationships that I think are important to the legislative process. I know, Representative Lilly, you have been at a Nutrition Commission meeting or two, and in the future, if you and Representative Jordan would be interested, you'd be welcome to join us. I know that Representative Anderson on this committee is also a member of the commission. He'd be most welcoming.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. You're right. It does build fellowship, and exactly that's why Representative Jordan's bringing this, and the testifier is just full of great story with regards to that. That's awesome. Representative Green, good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Morning, everyone. I do have a couple of questions. One of the things I was wondering is if you read the legacy amendment, I was just wondering how this fits in with the description of legacy. And I won't go bother reading it because I'm assuming and hoping everyone has already read the amendment and what the money's supposed to go for. So could the bill author tell me how this fits into the description of what legacy funds are to be spent for?
Thank you, Representative Green. Representative Jordan?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for the question. I think the testifiers really talked about how this is our cultural heritage. I think learning to cook is something that connects us to who we are and learning about what Minnesota is about. It's also talking about what unites us as Minnesota, whether it be agriculture, whether it be food, whether it be sharing our stories. I think that food in particular is a pretty tactile and sensory experience that connects us to culture in a different way than maybe some of our more traditional but still important aspects of our legacy fund are, like reading a book or watching a play. I think food and having that discussion about where the produce that was grown, where that came from, what went into that, and how turning those raw ingredients into really a work of art, whether it's a tamale or a bowl of pho or fish and chips even, how that is part of who we are and what that says about what we do and where we come from and why it's valuable.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. You know, Representative Green, these are interesting questions. We've kind of faced it every year, as new ideas have come forward. But when you do read the Constitution, I just kind of had it pop up here, to support arts education, arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. So I can see it clearly, but I can see how you wouldn't see it clearly, but I can definitely, Eileen as chair and other members can interpret how they see, but I think it's pretty clear it fits in there too. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's fine. I'm not slamming this program, but I do wonder if there's, you could almost give that description to anything you wanted. I could do anything I want and come into the arts and cultural heritage and say, this is part of my heritage and can I have some money? So it was just a question. I also would like to know, is this a pretty big ask. And from looking this up, I think that the last time anything came from that was at least listed on the committee, there was a $22,000 ask. And so the question is, how are you going to break this down and where this money is spent? Because, I'll just give you an example. This is a nonprofit. Are the people that work there, are they all volunteers, or are they going to get paid from this fund? Is the money going into overhead, or is it going into all for the program?
Representative Jordan, did you hear the question?
I did, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for the question. I think Ms. Horowitz would be better suited to answer that question.
Ms. Horowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for your question. I can tell you that we do have volunteers, but we do also have paid staff. However, these funds would not be going to pay staff and would not be going to overhead. Our Community Cooks Meal Box program, which is part of the expansion of our Community Cooks program, which these funds will cover, is directly the funds go to the farmers, to the growers that grow the food, and to purchase the ingredients that are not grown locally to supplement the boxes. There's some minimal cost in printing the recipe cards and then packing up the boxes and making them available to families. I'm not familiar with all the what like the typical ask is from the legacy fund, but I know I can tell you the total cost per meal box averages around $38 per box. We piloted the meal box program in August of 2020. It was supposed to be an 8-week pilot. It turned into a 16-week pilot. And then because the need was so great and because the response was so positive from our families, we extended it for an additional 6 weeks. And we've served, in 2020, we served 614 families. Each box has enough food to prepare two recipes, and each recipe makes six servings. So it's actually 12 meals per box. And so the meal box portion of our Community Cooks program is quite a bit more expensive than our workshops. Typically our workshops, we do buy local produce and we still support our local growers, but it's one meal to feed about 40 people, 20 to 40 people each workshop. And so the sheer cost of the food is what's driving this ask. And I wanted to also, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, to just briefly address the first question that Representative Green had. Would that be okay?
Just briefly, if you could.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly just reintroduce us to the term culinary arts. Cooking is an art form. This is a part of our culture, a part of our artistic world, and I'm certain that this is not a typical request that the Legacy Committee has gotten before, but I think it's a really important part of our art world, our culture, and our heritage, and so I think it's a good fit for what the definition of these funds can be used for. And thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got one more question, and then a request for some offline information just for me.
Okay. Yep, Representative Jordan will be available, and the rest of us, we can work with you. Yep, go ahead, sir.
Okay, the question is, what other sources of funding? Because it's, and you know, you obviously have been in business for a few years. I don't know exactly how long, but if this has been running, you must be getting your funding from other sources. So what other sources is there for you?
Ms. Horowitz, or?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for your question. We started this program in 2012 with a budget of $10,500. One grant was from the Wedge Cooperative, and one was from the Mount Sinai Community Fund, which is an auxiliary fund from Mount Sinai Hospital. But over the years, we've funded Community Cooks through all of the typical sources that you might expect. We have gotten some corporate support, some foundation, public and private foundation support, as well as individual donations.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Horowitz. Representative Green?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I'm not going to belabor this, but I would like to know if this started out then as a food program or if it started out as a cultural heritage. And like I said, I'm not going to keep pounding on these things. I just want to know. But if they could get back with some of that information, that'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Green. I know Representative Jordan and the others will gladly work with you. And I see a lot of head nodding. So Representative Jordan, you're okay with that? Yes. Okay, great.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd love to work with any member of the committee on this.
Thank you. Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing this bill forward. I've had an opportunity to learn more about this program, and especially with my friend, P.H. Copeland, who worked with Appetite for Change. I'm very excited to hear that this organization is expanding over to the east side, and I'm looking forward to working with you all to ensure that our communities who are not often at the table are being heard and have access to such programs that is very needed. And so, Mr. Chair, it is my hope that we can get some funding for this organization because this is very needed. And this is the purpose of a legacy amendment, which is to preserve our arts and culture. And this program is the nail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. We'll have to get over there and at the depot there and check it out this summer. So seeing no further questions, Representative Jordan, would you like to renew your motion? And you can do final comments before that, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I would just like to end with a quote from Paul Cézanne, who is a French Impressionist artist. And he, so one of, you know, someone who we would think of as classical fine art, and he would say the day is coming when a single carrot freshly observed will set off a revolution. And so I think with that, I think that really shows the nexus, and it says who we are and why food is so integral to our culture. And with that, I renew my motion to lay over House File 625 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you.
So someone needs to refresh my memory. Do we vote on that, or do we just accept that?
I think it's just right over, Mr. Chair.
So I, with that, this bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan, and thank you, the testifiers. I'm excited to hear more about the program, and just sounds like some really great work. Thank you. So we're going to move on to Representative Wasilek, as bill, the House File 867 in regards to public radio. Rep. Wasilek, would you like to move your motion and have it before us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 867 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. We have your motion before us, and go ahead and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Lilly and members of the committee, since 2010, Minnesota Public Radio's legacy funded programs and events have enriched Minnesotans' lives and strengthened the vibrant culture that makes our state such a great place to live, work, and play. House File 867 appropriates $3.9 million in legacy funds to NPR to maintain and build upon the programming and the events it has developed over the past 10 years. The funding will assist NPR in its efforts to build
audiences. Mr. Chair, I don't want to interrupt, but I can't hear Representative Wasilek. I don't know if she's talking too low or if it's my speaker, but if she could maybe talk a little louder. Sorry to interrupt, but I just can't.
No, that's good. Let's get this right. Thank you, Representative Green. I'm not sure. I did have a little difficulty too. So, Representative Wasilek.
I am having some internet issues today, so I'll try to get a little closer to the screen and talk a little bit louder. So the purpose of the funding is to build audiences for Minnesota artists, engage students in the K-12 system and college students with live activities and curriculum, develop Minnesota musicians and journalists, and preserve historically significant recorded events and stories for future generations of Minnesotans. In your committee information is a copy of NPR's fiscal year 20 annual legacy report that has information that's in the presentation, a map highlighting some of NPR's events throughout the state, and a list of NPR legacy programs with short descriptions. With me today to talk more about the request is John Kavanaugh from NPR. He has a short presentation, and then he'll be around to help answer your questions as well.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. Mr. Kavanaugh, welcome to our committee, and go ahead with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I am John Kavanaugh with Minnesota Public Radio. First of all, I just want to thank you, first of all, for giving us time today. But then we have meeting requests in and have met with some of the members of the committee, and we look forward to having more of those meetings today. I'm going to be moving kind of at a quick pace just to respect the timelines that you have and the other presenters that you have. So I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk to what Minnesota Public Radio has done and what we would like to do in the future with the legacy funds you have graciously offered us in the past. Let's see. Are you able to see the PowerPoint presentation?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great, thanks. Just a quick reminder, NPR has a statewide reach. We have over 80 stations throughout the state, and we have offices out in greater Minnesota as well, 6 to be exact. So we do cover the entire state of Minnesota and serve the population as well. I provide you with a map actually in the committee materials that is a better resolution, so you can see where some of our programs have gone to throughout the state. The metropolitan area is a little bit more difficult to represent just because of the density of people, but again, we go everywhere. This past biennium, or this current biennium, you awarded us $3.47 million, and I wanna just run through some of the things that we have done with that funding. I wanna point out the NPR archive is something that we've had since the beginning of the legacy program. It actually provides the public and also research institutions, journalists with the opportunity to go back and listen to a lot of the stories that we've done over time. It also archives a lot of the music that we've had, whether that's the Minnesota Orchestra or the St. Paul Civic Orchestra. We recently went through a redesign for that, and it's a lot more user-friendly. And I'm going to thank Representative Wozlowick for sparking some of that as well. It's a lot more user-friendly, and we're very proud of that. One of the things that's come about during the pandemic is actually we've had more people coming to the archive, doing more research, doing more just for personal use, checking it out. It's been a great opportunity for us to display what we've built at this time. A few other things that we've done is we've been working with the low power FM stations and some AMPR members as well. We have a certain expertise in public radio, public media, and we like to pass that on to the smaller stations throughout the state that serve smaller communities, but then also specific communities, whether it's cultural. It's amazing the work that they do, and we like to assist them by either giving them engineering assistance or fundraising advice, and the list goes on, and we're proud to be working with those groups. So we had 6 sessions over the past in FY20, and we're continuing that effort in FY21 as well. The Minnesota Diverse Communities, this is a new program that we are establishing. We are actually, we have a branch in NPR called APM Research Lab. And the research lab has actually been doing some incredible work with some of the COVID material that and information that's out there. We are using that branch of NPR to actually do some deep dives into the BIPOC community. And we want to not only get this information, but we want to share this information as far as what we in Minnesota are lacking as far as meeting the needs and meeting the expectations of those communities. I look forward to presenting this information in the future as well to the committee members. Again, I think it's a great opportunity not only for NPR to build its legacy program around these issues, but then also reaching out to other organizations and assisting them with that as well. I'm going to shift right now to the pandemic. During the pandemic, NPR made rapid changes to its programming, just making sure that that we are fulfilling our role with the legacy funding. I greatly appreciate the legislature last year offering organizations to roll over their funding from FY21 into FY22. We are hoping that we don't have to do that. We did shift, and we do want to make sure that what we were promising to schools and to other organizations would be fulfilled. And we've purposely focused in on the communities that are going to be affected the most. And those are some of the entertainment venues, the artists, the musicians, the bands, the orchestras that really are not able to do live performances and actually are probably, along with a lot of the businesses throughout the state, are hurt by the pandemic. And not to mention some of the isolation that some Minnesotans are facing. So we actually shifted to some of our different programs. We have Bring the Sing. Bring the Sing actually was going out to communities and bringing in to get together people to do a large singing opportunity. It was learning and then presenting as well. As we realized that we're not going to be able to do that anymore during this time, we actually went to Bring the Sing Home. And that was reaching out to all communities and giving neighborhoods an opportunity to come out and sing different songs during different weeks of the year. And we've had several of them, including one with Lean On Me, You've Got a Friend. And what's really been fun is actually looking at the media coverage throughout the state on this as well. It really was well covered. I was just amazed at, again, the participation of that as well. Another thing that we did is we realized that a lot of the artists throughout Minnesota are not having live concerts. And as they start trying to do virtual concerts, it's very difficult for them if they don't have a resource or a venue to do that. Our radio station has been very good. I think they're up to number 6 of the concert series Sounds Like Home. Again, we have tons of Minnesota artists who are starving for audiences out there, and we have done a great job of bringing some of those artists out to folks. And that was done online by The Current. Again, just fascinating work that they've done. Now, one of our preeminent and most visible programs that we have at MPR is our Class Notes program. It's a professional artist in residence. They come into the school system, they do curriculum, and they do concerts with the students as well. Obviously, we were not able to do that live, so we actually shifted rapidly. Our artists who are listed on the screen right now, there's a ton of them throughout Minnesota, but because they couldn't go into school systems, we did in FY20, in that we reached almost 29,000 students in 163 schools throughout Minnesota. We actually shifted to a virtual Class Notes program. We have Class Notes concerts, and I'm going to give you a little snippet of that in a second here. But then I want to point out that you have invested in time in our video library that we created. The last time I presented in front of the committee, I actually shared a video that was instructional for students. What we have found is that has been a great resource during the last year, not only for Minnesota educators to share with their students virtually, but we've had requests from all over the United States and actually all over the world. We have requests from China and from Australia and from Europe all over. It's been an amazing circumstance for us, and we've been happy to share that with them as long as it's not used in a commercial venture. But you have provided not only Minnesotans, but the world with a lot of opportunity to experience music and at the same time do it safely. I'm going to share with you a quick snippet of one of the examples that we have of our Class Notes concerts. This is a couple from Minneapolis, and they are just absolutely fantastic, and I'll let them speak for themselves. Here's a little snippet of one of our Class Notes concerts.
Hi. My name is Siama. I'm holding 6-string guitar. I use my 2 hands to play. I learned my guitar when I was 12 years old. So don't wait too long.
That's a good challenge.
Learn your instrument.
I learned piano, guitar, and flute as a kid and recorder. So that's good advice. Learn now. It's the best time to learn. I'm Dallas, and I'm going to be playing this shaker that looks like an orange. Sounds like that. Everyone always asks where I got it. I just bought it at a music store. Should we play a song for that?
Yeah, let's play Malembe.
Oh, I love Malembe. Mm. Maybe you can sing along if you know it.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, mama. Malembe, oh Malembe, eh Malembe, eh Malembe. Ah. Malembe, 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 oh Malembe, eh Malembe. Malembe. I love that one. So next, we're going to show you this instrument. Maybe it looks familiar to you. Looks like a xylophone, doesn't it? Or a marimba.
So this actually goes on and explains some of the instruments that and some stories that come from the Congo and Siyama's experiences, and then relating it back to Minnesota. And there's actually several of these clips that are used with the curriculum in the classroom as well. Again, they've been very popular over the last year. Let's see if I'm...
This...
There we go. We have a lot of other programs that we offer to the public. This is just a small list of them as well. Again, like I said, I can't do justice for everything that we're doing out there. My colleagues are incredible, and their resources and their connections and the people that they deal with are just incredible in the artist community. We are coming forward. We would love to see the state get back on firm feet and have the sales tax coming in. We are requesting an increase. We recognize that this is all dependent upon what comes through in the is it February forecast. So we'll be keeping an eye on it. We recognize the hard decisions that you have and want to respect that. I would be remiss if I didn't recognize Representative Erdahl and Representative Murphy and the work that they did in establishing some of the legislative guidelines. And I always like to bring in front of the committee things that wouldn't have happened if it weren't for legacy. These are things that establishing new partnerships, recognizing new venues, recognizing things that that wouldn't have happened if indeed we didn't, first of all, get into the legacy program at some point in time. Back in 2017, I think maybe 2016, the Capitol reopened. And as part of that, we participated in a Bring the Sing event on the Capitol grounds, along with many other things, including a fabulous fireworks show as well. Our engineers and the smart people that I work with on a daily basis, much smarter than I, actually thought, this seems like a great opportunity. And I want to share with you perhaps a familiar venue for you that never would have happened if it weren't for legacy.
Keep it in. I won't give in and just good. I think it's best for now that I hold strong. Maybe I'll share it at the end of this song.
Are you kind of done?
I am. I would just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, committee staff. We hope to get back to that venue in live person as well very soon. We do miss the Capitol. And again, I appreciate your consideration and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh. Representative Verdahl was the lead author with on the Capitol. It's just neat to see it restored there. We sure miss it. Representative Green, I see your hand, and go ahead, sir.
Yeah, just a couple of questions for the testifier. This is an increase from what you've gotten in the past years. So can you just fill me in, first of all, on what this would be, what this would mean for the compared to your total budget? What percentage of this is of your budget?
Mr. Kavanaugh.
I'm wondering what, of the entire budget. Oh, thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
Actually, what's interesting, thank you for the opportunity to address this. Our state funding that we receive actually accounts for less than 4% of our budget. The money that we receive does not go to overhead costs. It does actually pay for some staff work as well, but it's about 4%. The amount that we receive from state and federal government funding is under 7%.
Representative Green.
Okay, thanks. Well, then, if it's not too bold of me to ask, where does a lot of your funding come from then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, sorry, I'm rooting for protocol here. Actually, most of our funding comes from underwriting and from our members. Our winter membership drive just started up today, but our members are key to our organization.
Okay, excuse me, go ahead.
Representative Green, go ahead. Yep.
One more question, and I know the answer to this, but just for the sake of the rest of the committee, when the chair puts this bill together, he's not going to be able to probably fund everything fully. And just for the sake of your members, this is a scalable ask, correct? So if you don't get it all, you'll still be working on other things?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Green, absolutely. We are happy to continue with our programming. We would love to see an expansion of some of the class notes and artists getting out there.
Thank you. Representative Wasilek, thank you very much for this presentation. Any final comments? And then please renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the videos and the presentation did a good job of explaining all of the good work that NPR is doing with their legacy funds. And I would renew my motion that House File 867 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Wasilek. We have that motion, and the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh. And we're going to move on to the Wilderness Inquiries. We're a couple minutes behind. These poor kids are out in the canoes and they're probably freezing. So good morning, Ms. Rettler. And please tell us about what you're doing and what you've done and where you're going with the legacy funds. Good morning.
Well, thank you so much, Chair Lilly and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Christine Rettler, Wilderness Inquiries Youth Programs Manager, and I'm thrilled to be here today to share more about Wilderness Inquiries legacy proposal, connecting youth to Minnesota's cultural and outdoor heritage. Across every corner of the state, Wilderness Inquiries' mission is to connect people of all ages, backgrounds, and abilities to each other and the natural world. One way we do this is through our Canoe Mobile program, which aims to connect youth to their local waterway through place-based education and on-water experiences. Each year, this program serves 15,000 Minnesota youth and travels around the state to do so. A foundational aspect of Canoe Mobile is to help close the opportunity gap so many of our youth face today. A child's background or zip code or family socioeconomic status shouldn't be a barrier to them exploring and learning about Minnesota's rich history and culture. Communities who are historically underrepresented in the outdoors are facing even greater barriers to education and outdoor participation due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The need for accessible and inclusive programs like Canoe Mobile is and will be greater than ever. The pandemic dramatically impacted all of us last year. Even through this, our resilient partners and staff found ways to continue connecting people to the outdoors. An example of this is our new program called Mississippi River Explorers, a virtual experience that connects youth to one of our nation's most significant waterways through hands-on activities and on-site instruction. As we've seen from a year of digital learning, it can be challenging to really connect with one another. Because of this, we intentionally designed these virtual experiences so that just 30% of our time is spent in a large group and 70% of our time is dedicated to small group settings focused on youth-driven exploration and discussion-based learning. Now, while 2020 was a year of pivots and challenges, we did hear so much excitement and energy from teachers and parents after participating in this unique program. One teacher from St. Cloud shared with us, "This program is a high quality experience for our students filled with meaningful content, prepared materials, active participation, and addresses cross-curricular standards. It provides a virtual step out of our classroom in these times when in-person field trips aren't possible." Our current proposal to Legacy will continue to support experiences like this, educational moments that create a bridge from every student's classroom to Minnesota's expansive outdoor spaces and the stories and histories that help shape them. Our goal is to connect 11,000 diverse Minnesota youth to the outdoors in just 2 years. This new project will help us expand Mississippi River Explorers while it's still not safe to gather in person and allow us to cast an even wider net to reach new school districts, new students, and new communities. When it is safe to program in person again, our virtual experiences will just strengthen our traditional Canoe Mobile program by working with classrooms before and after an on-water experience and by engaging whole families in exploring the outdoors together. One of the last pieces of this project I want to highlight is our commitment to promoting equity in the outdoors. Wilderness Inquiry has been a trailblazer in this work for over 40 years, and the Canoe Mobile program continues to address this need. Canoe Mobile's youth participants are made up of just under 60% youth of color, 12% identify as a person with a disability, and over 60% of youth qualify for free and reduced lunch. This project would continue to serve youth who make up these demographics, as well as focusing our efforts to serve communities in rural, suburban, and urban areas across the state. Now, for our next portion of the presentation, we are excited to give you a glimpse into our Mississippi River Explorers program. Joining us from the snowy Mississippi River in Minneapolis, I'm super excited to hand it off to my colleague, Mary Lovelace, to lead us through a day in the life of Mississippi River Explorers.
Thank you Chair Lilly.
Just go ahead, Ms. Lovelace. I'm super impressed. Thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you, Chair Lilly and members of the committee. My name is Mary Lovelace, and I'm the Youth Programs Coordinator at Wilderness Inquiry. Welcome to St. Anthony Falls. I am currently standing on the Stone Arch Bridge, and the falls are right here behind me. And over here, I'm looking at the Guthrie Theater, as well as the Mill City Museum. And over here, I'm looking at St. Anthony, Maine, and Father Henderson Bluff Park. And we typically start the day with Mississippi River Explorers with a mystery of the day. This is a centering point to frame their learning for the session. And today our mystery is, how do you think this waterfall, St. Anthony Falls, has influenced all Minnesotans? Our goal of Mississippi River Explorers is to show the students the history of an area from as many perspectives as possible. And well before European settlers arrived, St. Anthony Falls, or Awamni, which means falling water in the Dakota language, was and still is an important spiritual place for the Dakota people. It was an area that was rich in natural resources like fish and maple trees and countless crops. And 12,000 years ago, this waterfall was not here. It was 10 miles downriver, right in downtown St. Paul. And due to the unique geology of this area with its sandstone and limestone, the waterfall we see now migrated upriver with the erosion of that soft sandstone and then the breaking of the limestone. Also, St. Anthony Falls played a huge role in the industry development of the area. For 50 years, Minneapolis was the leading producer of lumber. It was known as the sawdust town. And as settlers depleted tree supplies up north, they transitioned over wheat to wheat and flour production. And this bridge that I'm standing on right now, the Stone Arch Bridge, this was a train bridge that brought wheat from farms all over the Midwest to be produced. And as we look around this area today, you can still see the remnants and the repurposing of old mill buildings into apartments and restaurants and gyms. Today, the Stone Arch Bridge is a huge gathering place for walkers and bikers. And as we guide students through these places, they will also participate in small group discussions, sharing why they think discovering and preserving these places is so important. Our main goal of Mississippi River Explorers and these on-site presentations is to encourage and get kids excited about visiting these places that make Minnesota so unique. Through having the experience of listening to the falls and seeing the ruins in person, they will be more connected to their local history and to the outdoor places that have helped shape that. Thank you for joining me on this stretch of the river today. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to Christine.
Thank you, Ms. Lovelace. Very impressive. That's,
thank
that's
you.
Really, that's really neat. Ms. Rettler.
Thank you, Mary. And, you know, just to reiterate, as she mentioned, we really hope these on-site portions of our virtual experience give students just a little bit of a change of pace to what, you know, they're used to in their digital classrooms and really inspire and encourage the students to come out to visit these places or explore new places in their community. And now to shift gears again, our work happens in very close partnership with families and educators around the state. I'm super excited to pass it next to a longtime partner in connecting kids to the outdoors in Rochester, Minnesota. Matt Ruzek is here with us, and he is the principal of Riverside Elementary.
Thank you, Mr. Ruzek. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Matt Ruzek. I'm the proud principal of Riverside Central Elementary School in Rochester, Minnesota. And it's a hard act to follow Mary standing out there. I'm in the comfort of my office, so I'm sorry. I could have positioned it so it was looking out my window, but I'd be fooling you all. So thank you, Mary, for doing that. I've been the principal. This is my fifth year here at Riverside Central Elementary School. I started working with Wilderness Inquiry maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and I was then the principal at Churchill and Hoover Elementary School, which is also here in Rochester. Two very different school settings. When I came from Churchill Hoover, I'd already experienced the value of connecting and partnering with Wilderness Inquiry, but it became even more evident when I came to Riverside. Riverside is located right in the heart of Rochester. It's our most diverse in nearly every measurable facet. We have about 70% plus, between 70 to 80% of our students that qualify for free and reduced lunch. We have we house a newcomer center here, so we have anywhere between 40 to 70 different languages spoken in our building. We're really a hidden gem within Rochester. So if you ever want to experience the beauty of Rochester, you could just come in through our doors. But what we recognized right away was not only a literacy gap with our students, but also an opportunity gap. Students, and we used a site entitled Learning Ed, and they really have a focused lens on what that does. And students in poverty experience roughly a 6,000 hour gap of opportunity to their peers who are not living in poverty. And that's connection to their community, it's connection to opportunities, it's connection to world. And that's looking at things like family trips, like you all may take your children if you have children on weekend trips or summer getaways. My first year here, I came and Greg was still with Wilderness Inquiry and didn't have to twist his arm much at all to come with me here to Riverside. But we're situated right next to the Zumbro River, actually a tributary called Bear Creek. Many of our children did not know Bear Creek was there, and it literally touches our property. And it's not because they didn't want to, it's because they hadn't had the opportunity to be worked with in that environment. And so part of it's exposure, part of it's developing comfort. So our first opportunity to do that was by hosting a family night. And so some of the wonderful staff at Wilderness Inquiry camped nearby, and they offered evening opportunities for families even to sit in a Voyager canoe on land, just so that they could feel what it looked like, to touch it, to, you know, they just didn't have that experience or exposure. And then we moved on to snowshoeing and different things. We also partner with Trout Unlimited and the Department of Natural Resources. And so every single year we've had every single kid in our building, minus this year, of course, in a Voyager canoe on the Zumbro. And it changes perspective. It's a paradigm shift for our kids to see Mayo Clinic from the Zumbro opposed to walking on the sidewalk. So now they're cognizant of it. They're aware of it. They become investigators and scientists and historians. And, you know, our city has changed a lot. Our buildings are filled with glass and we have very few block and mortar left. But the river has stayed constant. And much to Mary's point, it's shifted and changed too, based on what things we've done to it. And our kids get to learn that firsthand. And so intellectually, of course, that's stimulating. But then the other part of it is we have students who, many of which were unable to swim. We give our fifth grade students tours of the middle school when they transition to sixth grade. Many of our children are afraid to go into the pool area because they don't know how to swim. That's a problem. That's an experience gap for our kids. So now we're getting them comfortable in an arena that is uncomfortable to them just by its nature itself. And all of them have gone into it. I have a number of pictures. I have one hanging on my wall here where we had a family that was new to us from the Sudan. And I have the mother in a tight blue life jacket and clasping onto her paddle with her three kids, who all then got into a Voyager canoe with the Wilderness Inquiry staff. Those seem like simple moments in time for us as we observe. They could be monumental shifts in what they see as possibilities in their homes. And we're starting to see that. Having now operated for 5 years here myself and bringing Wilderness Inquiry with us, it really is unmeasurable in regards to what that has done for the ability for these families to see what possibilities truly do exist, not just in our community. Now they're asking, how far away is Whitewater? How far away is the Mississippi River? What is it like to go to Lake Superior? So it's opened their minds, and really that would not be possible if we did not have Wilderness Inquiry, not only as a partner, but as a steward of learning and our outdoors and the environment. You know, we have students now that will see, we're next to a gas station. A simple example is that somebody had tossed a shopping cart into Bear Creek. Our students were up in arms that there was a shopping cart in Bear Creek. Prior to Wilderness Inquiry partnering with us, they didn't know it was there. Now they were upset that somebody had the gall to put trash into their stretch of water. So I can't say enough about what they've done for me personally and for our school and for our students, and students that really truly are only limited by what they're exposed to. And this is just another great way to get them to see what potential they have. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ruzek. That was amazing. What a great story. And that just really speaks to so much. Thank you very much. Ms. Rettler?
Yes, thank you.
Give more?
Yeah, just a few little closing remarks. Thank you so much, Matt. Now, as we leave you, I want to come back to the question Mary posed as our mystery of the day. She asked, how has St. Anthony Falls influenced all Minnesotans? The Mississippi River, the Zumbro River, the Boundary Waters, the prairies of the North Woods, all of these places have informed and defined the history of our state and our connection to the land and the peoples who live here. We are also writing our own history. The question we will leave you with today is, how will St. Anthony Falls, the Mississippi, and all of Minnesota's wild places continue to be intertwined with the history we are creating? And how are we sharing that with the next generation of Minnesota outdoor stewards? We really look forward to exploring that together in the years to come. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to share today, for considering our legacy proposal, and for supporting us in this important work on behalf of all Minnesota kids. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Please stick around. We have a couple of member questions, and hopefully we can work through that. Wow, that was great. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make this really quick because I don't want Ms. Loveless to stand out on that bridge any longer than she has to. She's still out there. But this would be for the testifiers. How does the funding that request that you have here compare to previous years, last year, for instance?
Ms. Rettler.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Green. That's a great question. I might have to get back to you with a little bit more specifics, but one kind of big difference this year compared to last year is kind of this now hybrid approach to our Canoe Mobile experiences. You know, last year, previous years, we have been able to gather in person, and now with the pandemic, we've introduced this new virtual Mississippi River Explorers program. So, you know, right away, the funds from Legacy will support kind of the expansion I mentioned of the virtual experiences. And then as soon as we can safely gather again, we'll be back out in our Voyager canoes and inviting all of you to come join us. But I can get back to you with some more specifics on that.
Thank you. Please do. Representative Green.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to ask the last one just in a two-part question. They can answer it, and then that'll be all I need to do for this. You know, you mentioned the virtual, which I would assume has to be much less costly than in person. It also, I think, defeats the whole purpose. So that bothers me, you know. But with the governor's shutdown, was there any savings from last year that you carried over? And we don't know yet even if he's going to open up the state. So you're asking for a considerable amount of money. And do you have any contingency plans in case you're not able to get out and you're still stuck in your office?
Ms. Rettler.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Representative. Great questions. It would, I think, you know, first thinking about a virtual experience versus the in-person experience, you would think that the costs are significantly lower, but we really value those small group virtual settings. So our staff numbers are still pretty high compared to, you know, maybe one virtual leader with a group of you know, a classroom or two classrooms. So we do have still a significant number of staff that we're using for these virtual experiences. And we, I'm not sure if I mentioned this in the presentation, but all of our students who participate in the virtual Explorers programs get a hands-on Explorer kit. So that those are all program materials that are sent to the kids, either to their school to be picked up or mailed directly to their house. So again, those are some program costs to the virtual experiences. But again, I can get back to you on some of the differences in the two programs.
Thank you, Ms. Rettler. And a final question, Representative Jordan.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you so much to all the presenters. This was a really great way to start the morning. I have a question for Principal Ruzick, actually. I love the way you talked about the change you see in your students' attitudes. I know when I took my nieces canoeing in the Boundary Waters and they saw me forging a canoe, my favorite memory was my niece saying, "Wow, Sydney, you're so strong. I hope I can be strong like you someday." She didn't know it was a pretty light little canoe. But either way, it was great to see that. Can you talk a little bit about any changes in academics you've seen with your students in the classroom as a result of Wilderness Inquiry programming?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Chair. We do see, we have measurables that we collect in all of these areas. One of them is attendance, which, you know, we directly link to student performance. And so what we recognized on the onset of bringing in WI was when we had WI here, we nearly had perfect attendance. And so being practitioners, you're forced to beg the question, how do you do that every day? We can't put them in Voyager canoes every day, much to my disliking. I would prefer to be in a canoe daily. But in turn, then what happens is the staff that come down and work with our staff and work with folks, even in our special areas like art, music, PE, will start to incorporate some elements of what we've done with WI throughout the day. So we have seen a steady increase in attendance, which certainly there are a number of variables that impact that, but we can directly link that as we start to desegregate data to the impact of wilderness inquiry. Another thing that we start to see is we're starting to do something in regards to evaluating growth rather than a stagnant point. And so when we look at growth results in our students, in particular, analysis and inquiry, which we can measure through presentation, which we can measure through demonstration, which we can measure in the production of some tangible piece, it really is pretty remarkable. And the other thing I would say too is independence. Independent investigation into learning is very hard to spark. And this is a launch pad for us. So as we start to look at our students, and I would say our students that are now fifth graders that started with WI as first graders have demonstrated a far greater ability in their willingness and desire to take risks, and not just in outdoor ventures, but reading, math, science, social studies, because they recognize, like you just said, that they can be strong enough to carry a canoe, and some of that is the hypothetical canoe. And then when we look at another one is in regards to things like standardized exams, which historically has shown a kind of a marginalization of students in particular that we serve, that we do see an increase in the areas of scientific method and exploration. So some of that manifests in maybe a segment of math. So those are all things that we've started to look through and see. But we're in the long haul in this. And so we've started to also collect data that we can see, you know, our students historically had a lower graduation rate. Well, now we have kids who have experienced this for five consecutive years, and we'll start to see the attendance of those students in middle school has increased. The participation in extracurriculars in high school has increased. So all of those are tangible measurements that we can see growth in. And I think we would be foolish to say that wilderness inquiry hasn't had an impact in that arena for our kids, which has been very historically hard to change.
Thank you very much for coming this morning and telling us your story, Ms. Rettler and Principal Ruzek and Ms. Lovelace. I'm still impressed. You're out there. I think many of us would be doing a little more shaking. You're doing great. Thank you very much. And what a great presentation.
Thank you.
So with that, we'd like to move on to hear our story from the Children's Museum. We're a little squished for time, but I think you can do it. You've got a great story to tell as well. And Ms. Greisen, please go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Diane Kreisen, president of Minnesota Children's Museum, and our mission is to spark children's learning through play. We curate exhibits and programs that are designed around how kids learn through hands-on, open-ended exploration that develops kids cognitively, socially, emotionally, and physically. We serve families of children from 10 years old and younger that come from all counties in the state of Minnesota. And it's been a tough year with the pandemic. We've had to close twice But we are reopened again as of mid-January under capacity limitations. But it's great to hear the voices of children again in our space. And I just wanted to share one testimonial from a mother that sent us a comment that was, the Children's Museum is our son's favorite place to go. He is 11 and has autism. He counted down the days to your reopening. You made such a difference for him and so many other kids who lost all of their normal places during the pandemic. So it is great to have the museum's doors open again to families. I'm gonna pull up the handout that we normally would have physically present for you. And I'm disappointed to not being physically present because I know in the past we've had the opportunity to bring some hands-on open-ended exploration for committee members to play with while I testified, but the world has changed for right now. So I welcome the time when we can be back in person. Our request for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund this year is $750,000. And I wanted to put that in context with our historical funding that we have generously received from the Legacies Fund. So here is the history of all of our funding since the beginning. And you'll see that $750,000 is $400,000 less than what Minnesota Children's Museum received in the prior appropriation. And the reason for that is previously we were representing two museums. We have our flagship museum in downtown St. Paul, and we also had a satellite museum located in Rochester, Minnesota. And I am pleased to say that the museum in Rochester has been nurtured to the point where they have been able to become an independent museum. And as of July 2020, they are now a separate nonprofit organization. And so our request this year is for $750,000, which we consider a flat request because the other funds we were directing to that satellite museum. And I just want to explicitly state that my hope would be, as I am pro children's museums, my hope would be that in essentially reducing our request for Minnesota Children's Museum, that that additional $400,000 could be used to support other children's museums in the state. Our request comes in two parts. So for that $750,000, and I just want to say that our bill is in the process of being jacketed, and I want to recognize and thank Representative Jay Zhang, who has agreed to author that bill. We just don't quite have it through the process yet. But that request of $750,000 will serve two purposes. One is to provide fresh new learning experiences within our walls at the museum in downtown St. Paul. And the second piece of it then is to get out and beyond our walls with that. So we have a variety of different programs that we're using. And I guess I also want to add into that we very much take a lens of racial equity as we think about the inclusiveness of the programs that we do. I want to quote from Just In Part, our board in 2018 adopted an updated commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. One of those updates where we weren't using the language of equity when the board had previously adopted a diversity inclusion value statement. And our statement that the board adopted reads in part that given the reality that a history of exclusion and unfair treatment exists broadly in our community, our values compel us to be intentionally inclusive and welcoming of Indigenous people and people of color. And so as I talk about the different programs that this funding would do, I want to kind of touch on then how we bring that into each and every element of what we do. So one of the experiences that we would like to develop for our museum is an exhibit that is based on an actual shipwreck in Lake Superior. It is a ship that sunk in 1884, and it sunk very slowly, so there were no casualties, which is very important to us as we're bringing content to young children, that there isn't a traumatic story that underlies that exhibit. And we're also working, in addition to working with the diver who discovered the exhibit, we're also working with the Ojibwe community, because as this reflects the heritage of Lake Superior, we want to make sure that the heritage of our Ojibwe community is also reflected in that exhibit. We also have a gallery that's called Imaginopolis that creates kind of very unique twists on the real world in that. So we want to take a theme of nature and give it a whimsical twist by making things outsized, you know, so that, you know, there's a mushroom or a flower, you know, where you're, you know, ant-sized compared to those things, to really spark kids' imaginations. And we are working with Black artists, paid advisors to this program that are theater experts in set design to help us create this experience. We also use the fund to work with guest artists and in community partnerships, providing stipends for their time, and think very intentionally about the breadth of diversity of different artists and different community partners that we bring into the museum. In the past a couple of years, we've worked with one community partner, for example, was the Center for Hmong American Arts that helped to co-create an exhibit in our space. And then as we move beyond our walls, we think intentionally about the communities that we go to make sure that we're very inclusive in bringing the joy of play out beyond our walls. And so I just want to note, because there's a reference here in this bullet point to the Big Orange Dance Machine, and I think a picture says 1,000 words. So here's a picture of what I mean by a Big Orange Dance Machine. And so with the prior legacy funds we created, working with MnDOT and Explore Minnesota, we created this idea of taking those digital signs that usually say, hey, you're going to be stuck in traffic for like an hour, and to program it so that you can use, there's some foot pedals here, so it's made COVID friendly now, where you can use foot pedals to program your experience, and then create your dance and their dance to it. And we use this as a platform to talk about the importance of play. So in addition to it, it's the way that kids develop their brains. It's also just really good for our mental health. It's really good for joy. And in these times when we've all experienced anxiety and loss and just the loss of the normalcy, as that one testimonial said, we're really looking forward to getting this out into communities this summer as a way to really champion play and to celebrate together and to just, you know, bring that, you know, connection and fun back into our lives with that. So I'll just pause there, given how tight we are on time.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Kreisen. And I know that you'll be available for any questions if members were to have them. Or it's kind of sad you're so close to us. We could zip down for a tour. And, you know, it's just, you've just been a wonderful host in the past and doing good work. And you've got a great author in Representative Zhang, and we'll grill him with questions when we get to that point. So I'm certain he'll be ready. So thank you, Ms. Kreisen, for coming today. Representative Zhang? Oh, he's giving me a thumbs up. I think his thumbs up said he's ready for the tough questions.
No, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You all know that the Children's Museum is a great institution in our state, and this is not just for the metro area, but throughout our whole state. And if you've seen how this institution has expanded its services beyond just the Twin Cities, so it is my hope that we can continue funding a great institution that has done a lot for our families and especially for our children in these trying times. And so I look forward to continuing the conversation when the bill comes to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zhang, and Ms. Kreisen, thank you for coming, and all the presenters today. What a great day. So many great things happening all over the state, and thank you, everyone, and with that, we are adjourned.